Well, this will be my last time for a year. So, good morning, everyone. Good morning, everyone. I call this meeting of the State Lands Commission to order. All the representatives of the commission are present. I am Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis. I'm joined today by State Controller Betty Yee and Gail Miller representing the Department of Finance. For the benefit of those in the audience, the State Lands Commission manages state property interests in over 5 million acres of land, including mineral interests. The commission also has responsibility for the prevention of oil spills at marine oil terminals and offshore oil platforms, and for preventing the introduction of marine invasive species into California's marine waters. Today, we will hear requests and presentations involving the lands and resources within the commission's jurisdiction. We recognize that the lands we manage have been inhabited for thousands of years by California's native people and take seriously our trust relationship with these sovereign governments. Today, our gratitude goes to the Nisenan, Wintun, and Miwok people who have inhabited the Sacramento River Valley and corridor and the foothills for countless generations. I would like to start our meeting today by welcoming Robert T. Hatch, Executive Director of Cultural Preservation for the Wilton Rancheria, to come to the microphone and say a few words. Mr. Hatch. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's Ralph Hatch. I'm the executive director over at Wilton Rancheria, and you know, the chairman, you know, we're very honored to be here to open, you know, the meetings this way and, you know, honor the people that came here or that's been here, the Nisenan people and the Miwok people that come from these areas. My job is to protect those things for the next generation, the generation. So, you know, all that, I try to gather the history, the culture, the ceremonies, all those things I protect. And I protect everything in the ground. And so, you know, I wanted to come here and I to share a song with you. And it come from William Franklin, Bill Franklin. You know, he helped preserve a lot of these things in this area. And he's been working with the state and working with, you know, the communities to keep these things here. And so he used to sing this song, and it was a song that was, it was a social song. But in our dance, when we go into the roundhouses and the hungies, that's where we go pray, and that's where we ask for things or we need help spiritually. So we would sing these songs, and we invite the people to come up to do that with us. And so what it was doing, it was bringing us all together to pray for something, to pray for the earth, to pray for the water, to pray for these things that give us life. And so, you know, I see it fit that I sing that here because we got, you know, going last night to the tree lighting and opening it there with my family. I've seen all kinds of different nations come and be a part of that. And, you know, thinking about California and how many people are here of different from different nations. And we all got to take care of each other. We all got to live together. We all got to do these things. And it's going to take all of us to do that, to change the environment, to change the things that we go through. And so I brought one of my monitors here today with me to help me sing this song. You know, he goes out in the field and he's on any kind of excavating. He's there to protect. And so I brought him here today, so I'm going to share that with you. And like I said, we're very honored to be here, and we're thankful. And, you know, we have laws inside of our own world that we can't go to somebody else's land and do a prayer or opening. We don't do that because it's disrespect to the people that come from there. And so it's good that we're opening up these things. And I've been traveling for the last few months for the chairman to say, hey, go do this, go do this, go do this. So, you know, again, we're just very honored to come out here and do this and to be a part of it. And, you know, ask prayers for everybody, for all your families, for you, to make good decisions on behalf of the people, you know. And so I'm going to share that. And if you guys can stand, that would be good. If not, that's fine. Ahenemiko, Ochoyane, Apolitum, Apolitum, Ayande Ko Kawana, Yande Ko Kawana, Yande Ko Kawana, Yande Ko Kawana, Yande Ko Kawana, Hama Hama Nimiko Tahe Nimiko Ochoyane Apolitum Apolitum Yande Ko Kawana Yande Ko Kawana Yande Ko Kawana Yande Ko Kawana Hama Hama Nimiko Tahe Nimiko Ochoyane Apolitum Apolitum Ho Ho Hey Oh And again thank you and have a good meeting. Thank you. Oh Oxtapanuksu.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hatch. Thank you not just for the beautiful sounds and meaning of the song, but for your inspirational words. There is nothing more important than all of us recognizing that with all of our differences, coming together here in California in a spirit of community and friendship, we can do anything. Thank you. So the first item of business will be the adoption of the minutes from the Commission's meeting of October 24th, 2019. May I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Yes, so moved.
Second?
Second.
Any objection to unanimous vote? Not? Motion passes unanimously. The next order of business is the executive officer's report. Ms. Lucchese, may we have that report?
Yes, of course. Good morning, and thank you. I do have a slide deck. Can I get the advancer? I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you. So I just have a couple of items I want to update the commission on. First is our decommissioning projects. I'll start first with the Rincon Island and onshore leases. We continue to make significant progress in abandoning the offshore and onshore wells at the former Rincon leases. On the island, 24 of the 50 offshore wells have been cemented back to the mudline. Onshore, 24 of the 25 state wells have been abandoned, and the removal of the wellheads and concrete well cellars are underway. Two private wells were also abandoned within this area using funds made available by Dogger. Thus far, 540 tons of concrete have been hauled to disposal from these operations, and a like amount is being processed at the lease area for disposal. We recently hosted a tour of the island with County of Ventura representatives as well as representatives from UCSB's Brin Institute, including the dean, to brainstorm and talk about options for the ultimate use of the island and disposition. It was a great, beautiful day, as you can see from the pictures, and we're looking forward to hearing ideas that UCSB may have for the future use of that island. Because we're making such great progress on the plugging and abandonment of the wells, we continue to be ahead of schedule and under budget. We're looking to start the CEQA process and the public engagement process on the ultimate disposition of these properties in the second half of 2020. Next, with Platform Holly, we have begun the first phase of the plugging and abandonment of the wells on Platform Holly. So far, we have been able to finish the cementing the production zone of three wells and are working on the fourth. Each well gets a little better. Working on each well gets a little better and quicker with less downtime, as we learned from the previous wells. So we're continuing to make good progress on that. Safety continues to be our main concern, and so far we have not had any incidences, so that's a good thing. Then in terms of an update on the Piers 421 wells, We have, as I mentioned at our last meeting, we have completed the plugging and abandonment of the production well there. So we are now starting to do some prep work for the additional CEQA compliance that we need to do in order to move forward on removing those piers from the shore zone there. As you can see, those are actually one of the last shore zone piers relating to oil and gas. And so we're looking forward to actually removing those from the shore zone and being able to have a much more smooth access way across the beach there. In terms of the Elwood onshore facility, no new operations have been done or planned at this time. The facilities are only in service for the support of Platform Holly, and that's supplying the platform and with required utilities for electric and gas services and stripping the small amounts of hydrogen sulfide from the gas that's sent in from the platform. We did hold a town hall event in November, and that was a successful event in terms of being able to update the community and the city on our progress with all aspects of the Platform Holly decommissioning. And importantly, we were also able to spend some time with various representatives from the tribal communities in that area that we're working closely with, both in terms of keeping them updated on our work out at the platform and at the piers, but also to help position us and them to be able to provide meaningful interaction and feedback and support if the unthinkable happens and there is an incident as we're plugging and abandoning the well. So we're continuing to build and enhance those relationships with the tribal communities there. We had a great meeting with them on that, and OSPR participated with us. Next, I want to update the commission on a couple of hazard removal activities that we've completed. This first one is dealing with the Cemex Wharf removal in West Sacramento near the Freedom Bridge. This wharf is under lease for a non-operational concrete pier and wharf structure that was originally built in the 1950s. Cemex had submitted an application for removal of the existing wharf facilities and the termination of the existing lease, and we began the initial stages of preparing a work plan and environmental documents for removal. However, during a site visit in May, staff discovered that the levee side of the wharf was collapsing and threatening the integrity of the pier and the wharf structure. And based on an inspection by our engineers on June 13th, we determined that the structure was critically damaged and required immediate removal for public health and safety reasons. And so as part of that work, we issued a letter of non-objection to fully remove the structure. And we're happy to report that the levee has been completely remediated, and the all the facilities have been removed. And so this is what it looks like now. Again, providing access to the river right there. Our next removal activity deals with the Crockett waterfront. As you may remember from our last meeting that was held in Contra Costa County, we had a lot of discussion around the future of the Crockett waterfront there. We have been working very closely with the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, BCDC, the National Marine Fisheries Service, Lynn Marine, and Hansen Aggregates to pursue removal of two abandoned vessels and 30 pilings. And so that work has recently been completed, and everybody did a really great job. And I actually have a video, I think, if you can help me play it, maybe, from our drone there you go, of some of the work that was completed as part of this removal activity. We don't have... Maybe press play again.
Is there audio?
No.
Oh. It's still playing.
Okay, great. Oh, there it goes. Yeah, nope, it's fine. Thank you. And so just associated with this, on the consent agenda, we do have item 16, which we're proposing a lease with the Nantucket Revitalization LLC to maintain and help with security and debris removal for the restaurant area onshore there. So this is really just a follow-up on a lot of discussion that we had at our last meeting about the future of this area and and working with the county and with our applicants for that area and other state and federal agencies to really do what we can to clean that area up. So we're really proud of the work that we're doing, especially since we don't have dedicated funding sources for this. So there's a lot of work that goes involved in trying to find partners to be able to help with this cleanup. So I'll move forward. So this is what it looks like now. Obviously, we still have a lot more work to do, but a significant amount of material was removed from that site. Next, I want to update you on our regulations for our offshore geophysical survey program. Recently, the Office of Administrative Law approved the publication of the commission's new survey, or excuse me, regulations. These regulations streamline and enhance the commission's existing program and seek to ensure that geophysical surveys occurring in state waters are protective of the environment. And next, the commission staff are working with staff from the Ocean Science Trust to conduct an independent peer review of the commission's recent report entitled The 2018 Assessment of the Efficacy, Availability, and Environmental Impacts of Ballast Water Treatment Technologies for Use in California's Waters. This has to do with our Marine Invasive Species Program. That report led to AB 912 by Bernarducci, a commission-sponsored bill that goes into effect on January 1st, 2020, and amends the Marine Invasive Species Act to delay implementation of California's ballast water discharge standards and authorize the commission to enforce the federal standards in the interim. During the development of the bill, commission staff encountered some initial concerns questioning the findings and conclusions in the 2018 report. And so in order to ensure that the commission's scientific review and decision-making process is grounded in sound science, staff has requested the Ocean Science Trust, an independent nonprofit organization dedicated to ocean health, to convene a scientific review panel and coordinate an independent scientific and technical review of the 2018 report. OST is working with staff to finalize the scope of work for the review, and it's expected to be complete in early 2020. The scope of work and final summary report will be posted on OST's website, and a technical report offering details from the reviewers will be provided to the commission. And feedback from the reviewers will also be useful for the commission as we prepare comments to the U.S. EPA and the U.S. Coast Guard during the development of regulations to establish federal vessel discharge standards under the recently enacted Vessel Incidental Discharge Act. And funding, finally, funding for this project is provided through a grant from the Ocean Protection Council. Just a couple more items I want to update the commission on. The strategic plan update. We are embarking next year. Well, we've already kind of started, but we will be embarking in earnest next year to develop the commission's next five-year strategic plan. We are tentatively scheduled for an early February 2020 meeting that's going to be focused on receiving and soliciting input and feedback on the commission's current strategic plan and what people would like to see for the next strategic plan. And I also want to highlight that consent item 46 on the agenda does relate to we're requesting the commission to authorize staff to retain a consultant to help us develop that next strategic plan, as well as a public engagement process associated with that. Two more commission personnel issues I want to identify. First, I want to acknowledge and congratulate Seth Blackman as our new chief counsel. Seth's education, litigation experience, leadership attributes, and overall collaborative and inclusive personality makes him the best fit for the chief counsel, and I could not be more excited and grateful that he took the position, and I think I speak for our entire staff for that. So we're very excited to have him up at the table with us today. And I really look forward to all that we will accomplish together as a commission with Seth's thoughtful and comprehensive legal advice, insight, and support. And finally, on a bit of a sad note, I do want to acknowledge and recognize that We have had three commission staff members pass away within the last 12 to 15 months, all in the same division, our Mineral Resources Management Division. And I wanted to request of the chair that we close this meeting in honor of them. Mark LeClaire, Raul Valdez, and Steve Staker. They all worked as inspectors and engineers in our Mineral Resources Management Division. And as you know, our commission is very small and we're very family oriented. So it's been a huge hit to our agency and in particularly that division that worked with them so closely. They were committed, dedicated public servants and we're gonna miss them and the state of California is going to miss them very much. And with that, I'll close my executive officer's report.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Lucchese, for that very comprehensive and thorough report. And I certainly support, we all do, closing today's meeting in the honor of the three staff members who've been lost in the last 12 to 15 months. It's really very, very sad. And I also want to congratulate Seth. Welcome to the team. There's overwhelming support for you being in this position. And as it's been said in the past, congratulations, you caught the piano. A lot of work ahead, a lot of complicated issues, but we know that you are up to it. And then finally, I just wanted to recognize just how much has been going on out there in cleaning up our beautiful coast and making it more, you know, more accessible and attractive to people in the communities who live there and to all Californians, and that the upcoming update of the strategic plan is going to be a great opportunity for all of us, both up on the dais and in the community, to really reassess and think about the priorities of the State Lands Commission and hear from the public about the work that we do and you know, what else we should be thinking about. So thank you very much. And commissioners, I'll proceed to the next order of business. Okay, with comments from commissioners.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
How do we not have that?
First of all, I wanted to also add my condolences to the three staff members. You know, this is a division that's actually pretty globally recognized for the work that they do. And so it is quite a significant loss, I think, for the state of California and even beyond. So thank you for the recognition of them, and we will duly recognize them at the adjournment of this meeting. I wanted to also congratulate Seth and really welcome him aboard. And I love the analogy, Madam Chair, of the piano. And that's, I would say that's probably most days for many of us in the work that we do. But also, I want to just say, with respect to the strategic plan, I want to just thank Jennifer for the strong direction that she's really taken to implement the plan. This has really been integrated throughout the organization in terms of the work that all of our divisions are doing, and I think it's really been just so such a great guide and roadmap. And I know for each of us as commissioners, it's really helped us kind of put a focus to, you know, where we want to place our emphasis and priority. But what I did want to say, too, is that, you know, our stakeholders have been really a wonderful part of this. And we're going to take the public process, we're going to take the process public, more publicly going into the next year. But I wanted to thank the stakeholders who we've been able to convene just to get feedback about how it's working for them. This is a partnership, and I think if there's anything about this commission that just should not go unnoticed, it's the fact that most everything we do is in partnership. And so I thank the stakeholders. We did convene a group, one with the ports and the lessees, and another that really represented the environmental interests and the environmental justice community, and we're happy that we have the environmental justice community at the table as we begin this new process. And but I'm just looking forward to beginning to have this more public engagement. The work that we do obviously has broad reach and really has impacts for a lot of people. But I appreciate it, Madam Chair, that you know, we have adopted this tradition of beginning every meeting now with the recognition of our Native peoples. It's so important and so critical that we not forget. And I think certainly the ongoing work that we will do to make our consultation process with the tribal communities more robust will also be just all the more beneficial to the work that we're going to be carrying out together. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And let me just say that when we start with the February meeting and the discussion of the update of the strategic plan. Commissioner Yee will be back in this chair as the chair, and with your experience in getting us to this point, I think it's going to be really terrific to have your leadership on the update. Okay, the next order of business will be the adoption of the consent calendar. Commissioners, are there any items you would like removed from the consent calendar?
I believe that Commissioner Yee would like to remove item 29 because she will need to abstain from that.
And separate vote.
Yes.
Okay.
So I have I can set that up for the commission to vote on the consent agenda to account for her abstention on that item.
Okay.
So I move adoption of the consent agenda.
Oh, can I? Not quite.
Yeah, let me remove some items first. So I'd like to remove consent items 11, 12, 23, and 31. And regular item 53 from the agenda altogether, and those will be considered at a later time. Item 29 will be voted on separately to allow the controller to abstain.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak on any item remaining on the consent calendar? If not, we will now proceed with two votes for the consent agenda to account for Commissioner Yee's request. For the consent agenda items, except for items 11, 12, 23, 29, and 31, may I have a motion and a second?
So moved.
Second.
Any objections? Seeing none, motion passes. For the consent agenda item 29, may I have a motion and a second?
So moved.
Ms. Lucchese, will you please conduct a roll call vote?
Chair, Madam Chair, thank you.
I hear myself.
Okay, Commissioner Miller.
Aye.
And Chair Kunalakis.
Aye.
Great. An abstention from Commissioner Yee.
Yes.
The motion passes 2-0.
Thank you.
The next order of business will be the regular calendar. Item 52 is to consider assignment and amendment of a marine. Item 52 is to consider assignment and amendment of a marine oil terminal lease located in the Carquinez Strait in Martinez. May we please have the presentation?
Good morning, Chairwoman Kunalakis and members of the Commission. My name is Dobry Tutov, and I'm a public land management specialist with the Commission. I'm here to present item 52, recommending the assignment and amendment of general lease in the industrial use issued to Equalon Enterprises LLC, doing business as Shell Oil Products. The lease is for an existing marine oil terminal associated with the Upland Shell Martinez refinery in the Carquinez Strait. Shell's marine oil terminal wharf is located west of the Interstate 680 bridge and Tesoro Marine Oil Terminal, and east of Martinez City Marina. To give you a better idea of the scope and location of the site, I will play a short drone video taken on October 22nd by Commission staff working with in coordination with Shell employees at the Marine Oil Terminal. No audio. The lease area includes an existing concrete marine oil terminal wharf with mooring dolphins at each end and a 16-foot wide approach trestle. Shell has operated a wharf for the transfer of petroleum products adjacent to its Upland refinery in Martinez since approximately 1915. The first lease was issued to Shell in 1948, and the company has been under lease for the marine oil terminal ever since. The current lease was issued in 2011 for a term of 30 years beginning August 1st, 2009. On June 11, 2019, Shell executed a sale and purchase agreement with PBF Holding Company, LLC, which I will refer to as PBF throughout the remainder of my presentation. The agreement was for the Shell Martinez refinery, which included the marine oil terminal associated with the Commission's lease number PRC 4908.1. Under the sales arrangement, all of Shell's rights and obligations under the lease will be assigned to Martinez Refining Company, LLC, which is a subsidiary of PBF. I'll refer to Martinez Refining Company as MRC throughout the remainder of my presentation. PBF is one of the largest independent petroleum refiners and suppliers of unbranded transportation fuels, heating oil, lubricants, and other petroleum products in the United States. PBF Energy currently owns and operates 5 domestic oil refineries and related assets, with a combined processing capacity of approximately 900,000 barrels per day. PBF refineries are located in California, Delaware, Louisiana, New Jersey, and Ohio. PBF, through MRC, plans to operate the existing marine oil terminal facilities without substantial changes, retaining the current employee base consistent with Shell's historical use of the site. As part of the assignment review process, staff performed a financial review of the assignee's assets and that of its parent company, PBF, to ensure their ability to perform under the terms of the existing lease. MRC is a new entity created on June 26, 2019, and will not have any major assets until the close of the sale transaction with Shell. MRC is a wholly owned subsidiary of PBF, which itself is a parent company of the various subsidiaries that own and operate oil refining and transportation facilities elsewhere in the country. Because MRC has no financial history on which to assess the company's financial strength and reliability, nor its business experience, expertise, and reputation, PBF has agreed to execute a parental guarantee to ensure the performance of MRC's lease obligations. Upon closing of the purchase, MRC intends to operate the upland and leased facilities in the same manner as they are currently operated. MRC will adopt and continue to implement Shell's operations manual for the marine oil terminal refinery, subject only to minor changes to reflect the change in ownership. The same oil spill prevention training and certification programs will continue to be maintained and implemented, and MRC has agreed to extend offers of employment to all of Shell's employees at the site, which will help provide continuity, safety, and smooth transition. The lease requires the assignee to insure and indemnify the state for any liability incurred as a result of the assignee's activities. Pursuant to the proposed amendment, the current surety amount of $2 million will be increased to $15 million, and every 5 years, the amount will increase based on the California Consumer Price Index. The proposed amendment will further require that after 8 years, MRC hire a third-party engineering firm acceptable to commission staff to conduct a cost assessment for decommissioning the facilities and restoration of the lease premises. Under the amendment, staff will have the opportunity to reassess the sufficiency of the surety 10 years after the effective date of the amendment. The 10-year reassessment will be informed by the results of the decommissioning cost assessment. The inspection and maintenance of the marine oil terminal wharf are regulated primarily by the commission, and the operator must comply with the engineering and structural requirements of the marine oil terminal engineering and maintenance standards, also known as MOTEMS. MOTEMS became effective in 2006, and Shell Marine Oil Terminal Wharf has completed 3 MOTEMS audit and inspection cycles, evaluating the condition of the facility. Several deficiencies were identified during these audits and inspections, which have been corrected or are in the process of being addressed for compliance purposes. As part of CEQA compliance, and as a condition of the current lease, The Shell Marine Oil Terminal is required to adhere to mitigation monitoring program. The facility is currently compliant with the requirements of that program, and MRC will be required to maintain compliance with the program during the remaining term of the lease. As part of the assignment review process, and consistent with Commission's adopted environmental justice policy, staff conducted outreach to environmental justice community stakeholders. Starting August 2, 2019, staff contacted via email and phone 49 different individuals and representatives of more than 15 environmental justice organizations. Staff has received no comments regarding the proposed lease assignment. Staff recommends the Commission authorize the assignment of lease number PRC 4908.1 from Equalon Enterprises LLC, DBA Shell Oil Products US, to Martinez Refining Company LLC. Authorize the amendment of the lease to increase the surety amount and require a decommissioning cost assessment. And accept a corporate parental guarantee by PBF Holding Company LLC for performance of the obligations associated with the lease. Thank you. This concludes my presentation. Staff is available for questions, and also PBF and Shell staff is here and available and ready to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tutov, for that thorough report. Are there any commissioners who would like to ask any questions or comment on this item?
Please, thank you, yes. Madam Chair. Just briefly on the terms of the lease, not a question, but just acknowledging the commission and the work you've done in terms of ensuring that the bond amounts are commensurate with the cleanup amounts and to the parties that are involved. It's incredibly important that we recognize the long-term benefits, but also the risks to the state when we enter into these agreements. So we're really appreciative that you have acknowledged that and see the financial risks that the state takes on every time it approves one of these leases. Mm-hmm. And we're very pleased to see that the bond amounts and also all the other requirements that will ensure that there is responsibility on both sides to keep our coastlines clean. So thank you for that.
Thank you. So we have a few people from the public who would like to speak. First, we have Dave Lesher, followed by Jerry Forstel, followed by Jeff Harris. Mr. Lesher?
Yes, thank you. Steve Lesher from Shell Oil Company. I am the government relations manager for U.S. West Coast. I started my career at the Shell Refinery in Martinez 18 years ago, and I'm very proud to have worked on this lease several years ago with the commission, so it's a pleasure to be back here before you. I just wanted to underscore Shell's support for transferring this lease to PBF. Obviously, they're buying the facility, but you know, in my role as an external facing person, my obligation is as much to the communities that we serve as it is to our shareholders, and I've been very impressed working with PBF. I know they share that commitment. This lease is among the most robust of its kind. It went through an exhaustive EIR process with several opportunities for public input, and I know that PBF is going to be a good steward of that lease, just as Shell was. So I really want to thank the commission. I want to thank Jennifer and the commission staff for the outstanding work they've done, and I would urge you to support the lease transfer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jerry Forstel. Is Jerry Forstel here? Here he is.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioner, staff, and members of the public. My name is Jerry Forstel, representing PBF Energy as the refinery manager designee for the Martinez Refinery, which we're in the process of acquiring from Shell, as you know, subject to regulatory approvals and so forth. My background as a mechanical engineer, I've worked in the industry for about 35 years, including 11 of those years actually in the Martinez Refinery in a various number of roles there. In addition, in a head office assignment for Shell, I supported the refinery from Houston. So I'm quite familiar with the facility, the people, the workforce. Thank you for considering the assignment of the refinery's wharf lease from Shell to PBF, which is critical to the refinery's operation, as you would expect, and the acquisition. Representatives from both companies are here to respond to questions, should you have any further questions. But because PBF is a merchant refiner without retail presence, I thought I'd take a minute or two to just give you a little background on the company. And to some degree, I don't want to be repetitive, but our profile shows PBF as an extensive growing nationwide, having a nationwide footprint, including in Torrance, California, down south for the last 3 years. And I'd like to give you a little more background. PBF and its subsidiaries own and operate domestic oil refineries in Torrance, Chalmette, Louisiana, which is New Orleans, Toledo, Ohio, Delaware City, and Paulsboro, New Jersey. We have about 3,300 employees at present, and which will increase to about 4,000 if we're successful in acquiring Martinez from Shell. PBF is also has a general partner of a Master Limited Partnership, or an MLP, which operates in terminals typically associated, terminals and pipelines typically associated with those refineries. Shares of PBF Energy have been publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange since December 2012 and PBF Logistics since May of 2014. As a growth company, we're now acquiring the Martinez Refinery, and your staff has done an excellent job advocating on the behalf of the state of California and its residents throughout the assignment process of the Martinez Wharf lease. We compliment Executive Officer Luke Casey, who did make a visit out to the refinery in October with us, and members of her senior staff for being responsive and responsible for taking steps like visiting the refinery, as I mentioned. As a result, PBF has satisfactorily met the staff's conditions of assignment. And so in closing, I'd like to assure you that if you approve the assignment today, we intend to continue operating the Martinez Refinery and the wharf safely, reliably, in an environmentally responsible manner following the close of the acquisition, which we anticipate in the first quarter of 2020. We look forward to responding to any questions that you might have, as well as your earnest consideration for the lease assignment. And thanks again for providing me the opportunity to make these introductory comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jeff Harris?
I'll pass.
Okay. Are there any other members here of the public who would like to speak on this issue? That is all of the slips that I have. Do we have a motion?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any objections? Seeing none, motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Item 54 is to consider authorization as trustee of the School Land Bank Fund for the sale of approximately 17 acres of state-owned school land. Consider authorization of a general lease of approximately 1 acre of school land, and consider authorization of an archaeological permit, all located in Inyo County. May we please have the presentation? Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Brian Bush, and I'm Chief of the Land Management Division. I'm here to present on item 54. This item is an application from Caltrans that consists of three parts: an application to purchase 17.13 acres of school land for the Olancha-Cartago four-lane highway project, an application for a general lease for a short-term right-of-way lease to provide access during project construction, and the third part is an application for an archaeological permit to recover cultural resources from a portion of the construction area. The proposed project has been in development since 1998. Caltrans is proposing to upgrade U.S. Highway 395 from a two-lane conventional highway to a combination of a four-lane conventional highway and a divided expressway. The project begins south of the community of Olancha and ends north of the community of Cartago near the southern end of Owens Lake. So there it is on the little corner of Owens Lake, a little zoom in on the state lines parcels. And there is the lease areas. The primary purpose of the project is to improve public safety by separating opposing traffic lanes, reducing access points, and widening shoulders. The project would also provide increased vehicle capacity, ease peak traffic congestion, and improve drainage in the area. The staff is requesting authority to prepare and execute a patent to Caltrans for the 17.13 acres of school lands which is needed for the project. The purchase price of $7,700 is based on an appraisal that was reviewed and approved by staff. The proceeds of the sale will be deposited into the school land bank fund. A short-term right-of-way lease is also required to provide access during construction. The land will be graded and compacted for an access road, but no other improvements will be constructed within the leased area. The proposed lease, which has a 5-year term, also includes 2 small parcels totaling around 1 acre. During preparation of the environmental impact report for the project, Caltrans discovered cultural resources which require further investigation, documentation, and preservation. The area of excavation is within the proposed sale parcel. Staff is requesting authority to execute an archaeological permit for these purposes, which will give Caltrans the ability to conduct work during the interim period while the patent is being processed. I would now like to introduce Jennifer Maddox, the Commission's Science Policy Advisor and Tribal Liaison, who will discuss staff's consultation with the Tribal Historic Preservation Officers from the Lone Pine Paiute Shoshone Reservation, Fort Independence Community of Paiute, and Big Pine Paiute Tribe of the Owens Valley.
Good morning. Thank you for having us for this time and on this item. I'm Jennifer Maddox. I'm the tribal liaison for the commission. And I'm just going to go over really briefly the process. Oh, my PowerPoint went away. Okay. Okay, and I'm just, for my little portion, I'd really like to just give a very brief overview of the process under which our proposed agreement came to be, because in terms of just the value and the importance, I'd really like you to hear directly from the tribes and the tribal communities that are affected, and they are also here today to speak on this item. So because I don't want to speak for them, I can just speak to the process. We became aware of this project, or at least I became aware of the tribal issues related to this project in approximately August. We have an ongoing relationship with the tribes in the Owens Valley due to our activities on the Owens Dry Lake. So we have a longstanding relationship, and we're also really well aware of the importance of this valley and its in fact, we're working on a nomination package to the National Register with several other state agencies and all the tribes in the Owens Valley. So that just is to speak to how valuable this area is. It remains relatively undeveloped compared to a lot of other areas of California where cultural resources and heritage resources are a lot either destroyed or a lot harder to find because of urbanization. So our staff became aware of this project in August, where we were requested to have consultation on this project due to some ongoing unresolved concerns that the tribes had related to excavation and storage of cultural resources and artifacts and also just cultural landscape values. The project was approved, the ER was certified, and the project was approved with its current approved alignment in 2017. But we, this came about to us upon the application for the sale. So once we started doing research and had our consultation begin, we ended up having a meeting down in October in Lone Pine, and that meeting was attended by Caltrans archaeological staff, environmental staff, myself, and then representatives from 3 of the tribes. So what the request was that the not having a cultural resources repository option local was problematic to the tribes and exacerbated the injury that they that they experienced from the excavation and removal of the artifacts. You may remember that prior last year, we also had an item on the agenda related to Owens Lake artifacts for their Phase 910 dust control project, where we had undertaken a review process for the Cultural Center repository in Lone Pine, where we had consulted with the Office of Historic Preservation and the Native American Heritage Commission, and we have found that that location was satisfactory for storage of cultural artifacts. So that request we were able to accommodate, and then process-wise, the other request that the tribal members had was that that an area that is adjacent to the sale parcel that contains the remainder of a archaeological site that was identified, that is integral to the continuity of preservation of the cultural artifacts and landscape in that area. So once we this is not the right slide, but I was just talking. you know, because there was some destruction of cultural resources and they could not be avoided, once we concluded consultation, we found several reasons to recommend to you today that this cultural preservation parcel be included as part of the commission's approval. And that has to do with three things, primarily. So first is we have our strategic plan, which talks in strategy 3.2 to continue our commitments through our consultation policy for early and meaningful engagement with Native American tribes. Second, we have our environmental justice policy. And as you remember, we had an outside independent review group, and that included Tribal Voice. And we did include several goals in our environmental justice policy. And this project really seems to be emblematic of how we can effectuate some of the goals of that policy, including Goal 7, which is to honor the importance of tribes' ancestral homelands, and whenever possible, actively support opportunities to empower tribes to protect, restore, and manage their ancestral lands. So there's a couple reasons that we found that that fit within what we could do to engage and to fulfill those environmental justice policies. And then thirdly, really within the broad spectrum of what is in the best interest of the state on this school lands parcel, which has a very, very significant cultural value to the tribes. And when we think about the best use of that land, what it would mean to do something else with that land, like build on it, would be highly problematic and would really be contrary to many of the policies that you have adopted here. So that is how we resolved that consultation. That consultation lasted approximately 4 months. We had several meetings with the tribes, several meetings with Caltrans, and several conversations internally. So that's all I have to summarize that, and I would just love to have you hear from the tribal members themselves, and there are three of them here today. Thank you.
Wonderful. Can I ask you, did you have an appraised value of the 45 acres?
The cultural preservation parcel, proposed cultural preservation mm-hmm. parcel, has not had its own appraisal, mm-hmm. but the appraisal was done for the sale parcel, mm-hmm. and because it is located
sure.
as part of the larger school lands parcel, we've put right now sort of the estimated appraised value of being the same or similar, but I believe that that hasn't been finalized yet.
It will require a survey mm-hmm. of the cultural preservation parcel so we could be very clear on the legal description, and then we can apply that to the appraised value to get a final price.
Right? But based on what we know about the value of the mm-hmm. easement land,
right.
what is our rough estimation of the value?
Very rough is around $30,000.
Okay, thank yes. you. I have some thoughts, but I want to ask other commissioners, any questions or comments? So I'm really intrigued by this because one of the issues that I understand has come up is a question of precedent setting, precedent for Caltrans, precedent for us. But what I see and what I think we can all really hear in your voice is that this is just one of those golden opportunities where you can recognize pretty clearly that for a relatively small amount of what we are offering, a parcel of 45 acres estimated somewhere around $30,000. We have the opportunity to live up to the goals and the strategic priorities of the State Lands Commission, which is to honor the indigenous people who lived in California, and that this site in particular has so much to offer. So I just want to commend staff for not backing away from this opportunity out of concern over precedent setting, because it was so clear that the opportunity here to do something really great at a relatively small cost to us was just too good to pass up. So thank you. And beyond that, I think we'll go ahead and move to public comment.
Yeah, thank you. And based on your asking about precedent setting, and it is and it isn't. I would point out that there are several land trusts have been established. Alma Munson has a land trust. The Kumeyaay have a land trust. There are tribal land trusts that have been established that have been very successful in achieving conservation easements and other types of repatriation. The Wiat have just received a repatriation of Indian Island up in Humboldt. And then in addition to that, I would just say that there has also been recently adopted by the California Public Utilities Commission a land transfer policy that any surplus real estate from investor-owned utilities that are looking for sale give tribal nations first right of refusal for that land. So while it is first for us, it is definitely very much in line with where the momentum of the state is going. If you keep in mind the governor's recent executive order and apology, and then also through what is happening with the Office of Historic Preservation.
But I think just I really do want to say this, though, because there may be a lot of things happening there around sentiment, right? And I understand that. But we also have to live by the decisions that we make in the future. Yes. And so what I would say is that if there's a precedent being set here, it's that there's a big opportunity for a relatively small investment, and that without necessarily creating a precedent for other things which need to be taken, in the context of this, but also in the context of the other circumstances surrounding them, that we shouldn't be unwilling to do something that is so beneficial because we're worried that that might force us into a position to prejudge decisions in the future, which may be more difficult. So I wanted to make that point. And then with that, thank you again, everyone, for that great presentation. We have three people who have asked to speak on this item. If there are any others, please submit your speaker slips. Kathy Bancroft, Jolie Varela, and Charlotte Lynn. Please approach the dais. Thank you. At the podium.
Good morning. I'm Kathy Jefferson Bancroft. I'm the Tribal Historic Preservation for the Lone Pine Paiute Shoshone Reservation. And first of all, I would like to thank the Miwok people for taking care of this land so long, so that we are able to all come and enjoy it and meet here and everything. And then I really want to thank the California State Lands Commission and staff for the support and just the breath of fresh air of somebody who understands and has been there for us and done really great things to help us in the Owens Valley, on the Owens Lake, and now with this project. I started working on this project, the highway project, and when I first came home from graduate school in 2002. It was my first experience as a tribal monitor, and it was very strange because I couldn't figure out half of the stuff they were doing and why. And I've been continued, and now in my they came to us in 2014 to consult, and they wanted us to consult with Caltrans. We said Caltrans is not a federal, they're not federal people. They did send federal highways, and we consulted, I think, for over a year. And it was very frustrating because we would sit there and talk and tell them all kinds of stuff and our concerns, and they'd come back to the next meeting like they hadn't heard a word we said. And we went on and on like that. And then they just disappeared, and we're like, okay. And it was all good until a little over, well, I guess almost 2 years ago now, we heard this project was starting back up. So we're like, okay. But since then, we have talked with Caltrans and the archaeologists and everybody, but it's been more the attitude of, here's what we're going to do. The project is a go. And so this is what we're going to do. We have gotten some, you know, working on the ground level and without being noticed, gotten some things changed, but pretty much it's like, here's what we're doing. And not listening to, you know, we tell them our concerns, they say, okay, and then walk away. This area is a really, it's sacred, but it's really special. It's a ceremonial place that has been used for thousands and thousands of years as part of the life cycle. And we don't want that word to get out because it just everything we let get out causes more problems, it seems like. But because of this project, it's all going to be destroyed. There's already been 30 years worth of archaeology in this area. They know how sensitive this area is. And we are constantly warning them, constantly talking, trying to stay on top of everything they're doing just so we know what's going on, trying to get along with them, and because we have to keep that open discussion and doing what we can. There are certain people at Caltrans who have listened, but a lot of them, you know, just like, well, we can't do anything about that. So it's a little frustrating. So it was really nice when California State Lands got involved because of their permit, because all of a sudden they're not just having to listen to us, and that backing of somebody who has some authority and can hold that permit over their head. So we just appreciate the patience and the persistence in making them answer to what is important. And this land transfer and just the, you know, we spoke and spoke and spoke for years about our artifacts are being dug up. They're taken from us right then. And I said, you don't have to take them. You can leave them here at our facility. And they disappear, and then we never see them again. Mm-hmm. So that's the hardest part, because we feel a lot of the restlessness and, you know, unsettledness in the valley is because our ancestors are sitting on the shelf someplace in a city far away, and they're not being cared for or even paid attention to there. And that's not where they belong. They belong where they were put, first of all, which hopefully with this land transfer we can at least, you know, put them close. But we do have a facility there to care for these items. And so there's no reason that they haven't even given us that little bit. So this is really big to have somebody listen to you and make somebody else listen to you. And so the actions at California State Lands have shown that the understanding, the knowledge of history, the compassion, the empathy towards how we feel, because this is a place that we've protected for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And who better to protect it than those who really care and know how to protect us? So we appreciate this.
Thank you. Thank you very much for those great words. Jolie Varela, and then Charlotte Lynn.
Manahu, Inaniene, Jolie Varela, Numunu, Payahunaru Yesh, Tuli River, Nukimaru. Hello, my name is Jolie Varela. I come from the place of flowing water and Tule River. I'm very happy to be here with you today. Payahunaru is also known as the Owens Valley, but Payahunaru is the original name for that valley that our people have called it for thousands of years, and it means the place where water flows. And I'm very grateful to be here with some of my elders today. I feel this is so very important, and I don't believe that you can place a monetary value on these artifacts. They are a part of our identity and our culture, and we would just like to see them preserved for our future generations. I've had the honor and the privilege to be at UC Berkeley working with the American Cultures Program there, and to be able to see some of the artifacts from our home that are housed there. And they're very beautiful, but I know that not all of us have that opportunity to visit and to see these items that are a part of our history and a part of who we are. So to me, it is very important that we preserve them and we keep them home with us. And that's why I'm here speaking to you right now. And I just want to say thank you, and thank you to my elders, really, who I get to learn about these things from every day. And just stress again the importance of this land and the cultural importance, and how we don't want our artifacts to leave. And they're not, to me, they're not really, you know, artifacts. These are pieces of us, pieces of who we are. And it's so important to preserve that for future generations. And I just want to thank you for that opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here. Charlotte Lynn, and then Frances Coates.
Good morning. Inanane, Charlotte Lang from the land of the Mono Lake Kwisatzka people. I'm Charlotte Lang, and I come from Mono Lake. And we're the headwaters of this valley, and we're having lots of issues in our beautiful country. And we want to keep our country. We want to keep it for our generations, for you, for your children, your grandchildren, to come and enjoy this land. But in order to preserve our heritage, we need to take care of our sources and our elders and our cultural resources and the land. And this is a big step. It's a small step. It's a huge, huge, huge thing for our elders to see, that people are starting to get a heart and recognize that us Indian people have a voice, and we take care of our people and our spirits and our land. We're not there just because we were put there. We are the first people of this country, and we really appreciate this small endeavor. And state lands is just in the bottom of our heart to stick with us on this. We were in Berkeley, and we're reaching out to other cultures and feeling their pain as well as ours, and speaking with these young people who are moving up in this world and able to make change as well as us is a great honor to start speaking. And what we all care about is this land. And we need all of you, as well as these young students, to help us get it back and keep it. I've been in Sacramento since I was a little kid, and I just go, oh gosh, that used to be so pretty, and now it's all concrete. You know, when do we stop? When do you start thinking of this land and enjoying it and keeping it pretty? The beautiful fall flowers, the beautiful flowers on the trees that are falling so graciously. Let's keep it and think about what we can do for these lands. And I would really like to honor the governor for his kind words and recognizing it and apologizing to our people. We accept it. It's small, but it's a big deal, and it's in the right movement. But there again, in my language, we say Nanaka. And every time we say Nanaka, we don't have a thank you. We don't have a lot of words in the English language. But when we say Nanaka, that means we grow. So Nanaka, let's all grow together. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. And then finally, I have Frances Coates. If there's anyone else who would like to speak on this item, please submit a speaker slip. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Frances Coates. I was wondering, in the transfer of the 45-acre parcel, were they going to reserve the fishing rights on that?
Mr. Vogel? Or Ms. Lucchese?
We are still working through the details. We actually have a meeting scheduled with Mr. Coates later in the week to talk about a number of things, so we can work on answering that question with him then.
Okay. So any other discussion on this item? Do we have a motion?
I'll move, and I am really grateful for the comments, Madam Chair, and hope that your ancestors do, in fact, find some peace. So thank you for sharing, and I learned a lot. Second?
I second that motion.
Any objection? Seeing none, motion passes unanimously. Item 55 is to consider adopting a resolution supporting infrastructure projects and operational changes to prevent transboundary pollution in the Tijuana River Valley and Pacific Ocean. May we have the presentation, please?
Yes, I will be giving this presentation, and I believe that we have a PowerPoint for this. There we go. All right. So this past Tuesday, several agencies and cities came together to support a consensus resolution recommending actions for the federal government to take to eliminate transboundary flows in the Tijuana River Valley. Due to a lack of adequate water infrastructure, transboundary flows are a significant source of untreated sewage, trash, sediment, hazardous chemicals, heavy metals, and toxins. These flows severely impact waters and communities, resulting in public health, environmental, and safety crises. One of the Commission's primary goals over the past couple years has been to find and advocate for solutions to the transboundary pollution impacting Southern California's public trust lands. This resolution identifies the most urgent actions needed from the federal level to address the underlying causes of sewage, sediment, and trash. The resolution requests that the federal government do the following: allocate funding to the US EPA to carry out capital projects already identified, restore and maintain the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of the Tijuana River Valley, and authorize and direct the US EPA and the International Boundary and Water Commission to cooperate and expeditiously execute projects. So, in summary, staff recommends adopting the resolution calling on the federal government to act on the Tijuana River Valley pollution. And if adopted, the commission will join several agencies and local cities in a unified call for urgent action. The joint resolution includes the County of San Diego, the City of San Diego, the City of Imperial Beach, the City of Chula Vista, the City of Coronado, the Port of San Diego, the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board, the State Lands Commission, and the Surfrider Foundation. And with that, we ask for your aye vote.
Do we have any comments from commissioners or questions?
Yeah, I'll make a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, thank you. I think this resolution is really memorializing a lot of the focus by all the different entities on the work that needs to be done. And I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for really elevating these issues as well with respect to, I think there's a lot of will to do a lot of good work there, but just the presence of the State Lands Commission, the leadership that we're showing, and certainly the encouragement that we will be there in a sustained way to be sure that we really are going to make some good progress here. So I appreciate the resolution and would make a motion to adopt it.
All right. We have a motion on the table. Before I call for a vote, I have spent a little bit of time down there on the border and in Mexico meeting with people on both sides of the border who've been working on this issue for a long time. It has gotten worse over the years as the population, particularly in Tijuana, has grown. And what I saw the first time I went down there really was, I couldn't really believe my own eyes, because we don't have these kinds of sewage flows in California. We build water treatment plants. We build infrastructure. We ensure that our cities and our communities are built in a way that we don't have these kinds of polluting situations. But because of the nature of the flows of water over the border, we have a very, very serious problem. And there are things that we can do on our side. And so the allocation by the legislature of California to enhance the infrastructure on our side of the border that's a very important first step. The commitment on the other side of the border to improving the infrastructure on the Tijuana side is really very key to resolving this. But in the meantime, we have a pollution issue on the beaches of San Diego and within the Tijuana River Valley that is in desperate need of advancing solutions. And it is going to take all of us working together. There are people who are down in the San Diego area on our side who have been working on this for a long time. There is a lot of knowledge now on what needs to be done, what can be done. There are many overlapping jurisdictions that are all committed and working together right now. We have the leadership of Senator Dianne Feinstein in Washington. We have people within this administration in Washington who are committed. And just this week, I had the opportunity to be with Governor Newsom in San Diego as he signed the MOU to reestablish the Commission of the Californias, along with the governors of Baja California and Baja California Sur, Governor Mendoza and Governor Bonilla. So the players are in place. The issue is raised to a very high level. This vote today will help to advance that. There is no question that the State Lands Commission has a very important leadership role to play, but this is truly one of those things where it is a concerted effort by people on the ground who've been working on this for a long time, along with the leadership of the state of California and the leadership of the Mexican government as well, that is going to get us to resolution. It's not going to happen immediately. It's not going to be easy. But there are solutions that can be implemented quickly, and there are longer-term solutions, all of which I know that we are going to be able to make progress on this. So thank you for bringing this before us. And with that, I will call for a vote. Is there any objection to a unanimous approval? Seeing none, motion carries unanimously. Item 56 is an informational presentation by the Board of Forestry on the California Vegetation Treatment Program. May we have the presentation, please?
I'd like to introduce Executive Officer Matt Diaz from the Board of Forestry.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Madam Chair, Commissioners, Matt Diaz, Board of Forestry and Fire Protection. Thank you.
Point that mic towards your mouth.
Are we on? I actually have one of those voices that often does not need a microphone. In accompaniment with me today is
if
Heather.
You could actually start over, because I don't know that
I'm
they
sorry.
Caught your introduction through the mic.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Commissioners, my name is Matt Diaz. I'm the Executive Officer with the State Board of Forestry and Fire Protection. And with me today, I have Heather Blair with Ascent Environmental. Ascent Environmental has been a key player over the course of the last year on the project that we're going to be giving you a brief introduction on today. And today we are going to be covering the California Vegetation Treatment Program and the programmatic EIR that the board has been working on. We lovingly call it the CalVTP. It's been rebranded in the course of the last year and a half or so. About last year or so, we rebranded it CalVTP. This has been a project that the State Board of Forestry and Fire Protection has been working on for about 15 years now. So the goals, and I would say in the interest of time, we are going to attempt to keep this presentation at 15 minutes or less, but we want to provide ample time for you guys to answer any questions or ask any questions that you may have. Our goal for today is, again, to cover not only the program in which we're analyzing, but also the programmatic EIR that's going to be put forth and considered by the Board of Forestry soon. We're going to cover the intended uses and get into some level of detail on the project-specific analysis, which would be the tiered projects that would come off of this programmatic EIR. So the State Board of Forestry and Fire Protection is proposing the CalVTP. As I stated, we've been working on this for quite some time, and as the wildland fires have become a greater issue in terms of not only impacts on wildland resources, natural resources, but also to life and assets within the state of California, this CalVTP has become a critical piece of the prevention goals of the state, wildland fire prevention goals of the state. The structure of this CalVTP has kind of changed over the course of the last year or so, where initially when we were working on this, the initial thought was that this was going to be a CalFire program and CalFire was going to be the primary implementing entities. Since over the course of the last year, we kind of changed our trajectory, and the new iterations of this program EIR has been redrafted to allow multiple government agencies, both local and state, to take on a lead role agency as it relates to implementing projects ultimately under this PEIR. So the vision is Cal Fire will be the primary implementing agency, while other agencies, State Lands Commission, could be one of them. Coastal Commission, local water districts, any local government or state agency could. Any local or government agency could participate in a vegetation treatment program under this EIR once it's certified. The final program EIR was released just last week, November 27th, made available. It's on the board's website. We have sent out information as it relates to this final draft widely. It's been disseminated not only to public stakeholders, but as well to agency stakeholders. State Lands Commission was one of them. You guys were one of the entities that provided comment letters on the NOP when it was published earlier in this year. Just as a means of trying to highlight the importance of this particular program, last year, Senate Bill 632 was chaptered. And 632 mandates the State Board of Forestry and Fire Protection have this program in place no later than February 1st of this next year of 2020. Our internal guidelines or our internal goals is to have the project done by the first of the year. So we do believe that we are going to be well within the thresholds of 632. But this particular program has caught the interests at the highest levels within our state governance. The ultimate goal of the CalVTP is to treat approximately 250,000 acres of non-federal land within the state for wildland fire prevention. So that 250,000 acre threshold is what the program has been analyzed at. In order to get to that threshold, it's going to take the highest level of cooperation between all entities out there, all stakeholders, to get to that threshold. I do not believe that initially as the program is being implemented, we're going to get to that number. But I think over the course of time, as we become familiar with the program, I think that the opportunity will arise. The CalVTP is a CEQA document. It contains an analysis of all physical environments and all impacts as required by the California Environmental Quality Act. It is one tool that is intended to help implement Governor Brown's Executive Order B-5218. And for those that you may not be familiar with B-5218, towards the end of Governor Brown's tenure, he offered this executive order after significant wildland fires and loss of life and structures and natural resources, and has pushed or mandated that our state move towards this increasing pace and scale message. The message is to increase pace and scale of vegetation management. This is really important because I believe that there's some misconceptions as it relates to some of the public perception of the CalVTP, that this is the only effort that the state is engaging in as it relates to wildland fire prevention, and this is simply one tool. We all recognize, the State Board of Forestry and Fire Protection recognizes it as well as many entities recognize that wildland fire prevention takes a lot of different actions, if you will. Public outreach, land use planning, building codes, all these pieces play an integral role. The State Board of Forestry and Fire Protection role is generally forestry and fire protection and veg management. And so we have been asked at this point to engage in the veg management piece of this. But we also deal with land use regulations, and we also engage closely on building codes. And so we recognize that this is just one tenet to a greater strategy as it relates to wildland fire prevention. What the treatment area, if you will, that's contained within PEIR is 20.3 million acres. So we identify 20.3 million acres within the state of California. We analyze, I should say, 20.3 million acres within the state of California as area that projects for wildland fire prevention could occur. When I talk about cooperation between different agencies, we have quite a few agencies within CNRA, within the California Natural Resources Agency, that are land management agencies. State Parks, State Lands Commission, DWR, all own or manage, I should say, on behalf of the public trust lands. State Lands Commission appears from our analysis of data that we've received through GIS layers that State Lands Commission has about 65,000 acres within that treatable landscape. And so part of the rationale of coming to here and working with your senior staff is to try to work together with CAL FIRE, the Lands Commissions, and DFW, and the cooperative under our agency, under CNRA, to effectuate this program in the very near future. The treatable landscape is available online. You can get on our website. It's a GIS layer. It's easy to navigate. We do not have ownership patterns there. It's a treatable landscape in its entirety, along with some other data, but not down to the granular level that's going to show where State Lands Commission resides within that treatable landscape. But we do have the data and can get it to you if you need it. Proposed treatment types are three types. We have three proposed treatment types. This is really important. Ecological restoration is key. Fuel breaks are key. And wildland-urban interface fuel reduction projects are key. So when we speak about wildland-urban interface, we're talking about veg management treatments around communities at risk so that wildland fire does not enter into those communities and vice versa, fires within those communities do not enter the wildlands. Fuel breaks are strategically placed, generally in what we would consider, outside of the wildland urban interface zone of influence. And these are focused on suppression activities, allowing for CAL FIRE to strategically place assets during suppression activities and effectively fight a wildland fire. And then ecological restoration is focused on trying to successfully migrate veg types that have been where wildland fire or fire in general has been excluded from those landscapes, and that departure of fire has resulted in a makeup of veg types that are no longer resilient to fire, if you will. So we are looking at trying to engage in higher levels of prescribed fire activity, and this ecological restoration piece is looking at trying to have landscapes or veg types that are going to effectively respond to prescribed fire. So these are the treatment activities. So we talked about the project types, and these are the treatment activities that are being analyzed. Prescribed burning, manual vegetation treatment, mechanical vegetation treatment, prescribed herbivory, which is the use of animals, if you will, targeted grazing, and targeted ground application of herbicides where necessary. So we have this matrix of three project types with these treatment types, and ultimately that menu is going to be what the projects will ultimately push forward by project proponents, if you will. So with that said, I'm going to pass it to Heather, and she's going to give you some additional detail on the mechanics of the PEIR itself.
Thanks, Matt. Again, I'm Heather Blair with Ascent Environmental. We've been under contract with the Board of Forestry and Fire Protection since late last year to prepare this program EIR. As Matt was saying, essentially the CALV-TP is a toolbox of treatment types and treatment activities that can be selected by project proponents in designing treatment projects to reduce wildfire risk. SPRs are another integral part of the CALV-TP. They function to avoid and minimize environmental impacts and comply with applicable environmental regulations. They will be integrated into later vegetation treatment projects under the CALV-TP as a standard part of treatment design and implementation. These are the product of extensive interagency coordination efforts, as Matt alluded to. We've been working with the Coastal Commission, with CDFW, with the California Air Resources Board, and the State Water Quality Control Board, as well as some regional water quality control boards, to develop these standard project requirements. So now that I've told you a bit about the CALV-TP itself, we'd like to tell you a bit more about the program EIR for the CALV-TP. CEQA allows for use of a program EIR for a series of actions that can be characterized as one large project or related to a continuing program. That is indeed the CALV-TP. One of the main functions of a program EIR is to facilitate CEQA review of later activities, in this case, later vegetation treatment projects that are consistent with a program EIR. As Matt was saying, one of the features of this program EIR is that it's designed for use by many agencies, or what the program EIR calls project proponents. That is defined as CAL FIRE or other public agency that is providing funding for vegetation treatment or with land ownership or land management responsibilities or other regulatory responsibility in the treatable landscape. So as Matt said, CAL FIRE would be by far and away the project proponent with the largest implementation responsibility, given that 95% of the treatable landscape is private, but other land owners such as CDFW and state parks or State Lands Commission could use this program EIR to reduce wildland fire risk. So we prepared quite a comprehensive EIR that endeavored to anticipate any impact that could occur from vegetation treatment throughout the state. 16 resource areas were analyzed. They're listed here. They include air quality, biological resources, cultural and tribal resources, greenhouse gas emissions, hazardous materials, hydrology, etc. So how will CAL FIRE and project proponents use this program EIR as a CEQA tool to facilitate that increase in pace and scale of vegetation treatments? Project proponents must evaluate that later treatment project to determine the extent to which the project is consistent with the activities in the CAL-VTP and the impacts that were analyzed in the program EIR. This evaluation will be documented in what's called a project-specific analysis, or a PSA. And if that later vegetation treatment project is found to be within the scope of the CAL-VTP program EIR, then no additional CEQA document need be prepared or circulated to the public. And in this case, a notice of determination would be filed if the project is approved. So what does it mean for a later project to be within the scope? It means that the activities are consistent with those that were described in the program EIR, that it's within the treatable landscape, and that it's consistent with the impacts analyzed in the program EIR, meaning that there are no new impacts or no impacts that are substantially more severe than those significant impacts that were identified. And where later activities or later vegetation treatment projects do not qualify for this within the scope finding, the program EIR can be used to focus only on those impacts that are new or substantially more severe in a site-specific negative declaration, mitigated negative declaration, or a focused EIR. So this flow chart here, it illustrates the CEQA streamlining process that is allowed for under the CAL-VTP program EIR and the different pathways that get you to a within-the-scope finding or an additional CEQA document. So it is the use of the program EIR by many project proponent agencies, and particularly the maximum use of within-the-scope findings, that will facilitate the increase in pace and scale of vegetation treatments while maintaining environmental protections. I'll also say that this program EIR requires the public availability of information that goes well above and beyond the requirements of CEQA for a program EIR. Information needs to be made available to the public at three stages: at the planned project stage, the approved project stage, where the project-specific analysis is available, as well as the completed project stage. Here's a slide showing our schedule and next steps. As Matt mentioned, the final program EIR has been released. The board will consider it for approval and certification this month. And in 2020, implementation will begin, including training on how to use this program EIR and how to complete a robust project-specific analysis throughout the state for some of these potential project proponents, as well as continued interagency coordination to develop the PSA and implementation. That concludes our presentation. If there are any questions.
Okay, I think we may have some. Ms. Lucchese, did you have something?
I was just going to thank Matt for the presentation and also try to tie it back to an action that you actually approved in the consent agenda. And
try to package this in a more direct way. So under item 47, you authorize staff to pursue either an interagency agreement or consultant services to inventory our school lands, primarily the 55,000 acres that are forested. And so as we move towards that process of inventorying those lands for purposes of better managing those for wildfire prevention purposes, assuming that the Board of Forestry approves or certifies the EIR, as we move forward to actual project implementation for that vegetation management, we will be saving significant time, resources, and school lands funds because we'll be able to utilize the programmatic EIR as part of our CEQA compliance. And so I just want to thank that effort because it really makes our management responsibilities and opportunities a lot more streamlined and effective, and we get to be able to be more efficient with the use of our school land funds.
So are the 55,000 acres of school lands that are forested that we are doing and conducting an inventory on, are they within the 250,000 acres that this EIR will cover?
They appear to be.
Yes.
And we can verify that using GIS.
Now, one of the things with our forested land, our school lands, is that they tend to be in the middle of federal lands. So how is the proposed VTP, if approved, consistent or not consistent with the protocols for federal land?
So the EIR itself, PEIR, applies to non-federal lands. But it's important to realize that the state of California has asked to increase its pace and scale to 500,000 acres of treatment a year, and our federal partners have come forward and set that same goal. So in terms of environmental compliance...
Sorry, say that again?
The state of California has identified that they want to increase the pace and scale of veg management activities to 500,000 acres a year, 500,000 acres a year. We're currently achieving about 250. Okay, so that's where the 250,000 that's being analyzed under the program is. The federal partners have identified that same goal. So ultimately, we are trying to cooperatively treat up to 1 million acres a year in California for veg management for wildland fire prevention.
So this EIR will cover the 20 million acres that you mentioned?
The EIR covers the 20 million acres of non-federal. But there's a lot of cooperation between federal and state agencies right now. So the fact that your lands lie within the federal landscape, although the EIR itself, the PEIR, would not assist the feds, the messaging and cooperation between the efficiencies of this PEIR and federal NEPA documents is something that we're looking at very closely. So there is a bit of a demarcation of in terms of being able to achieve the goals on non-federal lands and federal lands, but there is the highest level of cooperation in achieving those goals together right now, if that makes sense.
Okay, so that was my first question. My second question is this. When you talk about controlling vegetation, there are lots of ways to do it. You can put cows, you can mow it, you can put chemicals. What do you have in this EIR that would be the actual mechanism for controlling the vegetation?
That would be the treatment types. So that when I, on my last slide, I believe, I think it's slide 7 maybe or 8, those are the actual treatment types, which would be mechanical mastication, that would be heavy equipment.
Okay.
There are hand crews that we can use for sure, like the anyone from CAL FIRE's hand crews, prevention activities through the CCCs, private contractors, so actual hand crews.
Hold on, let's get your slide back up here. Okay.
So I don't see it up here, but the treatment types are there before you. And so those are the analyzed treatment types. You did. That was my last slide that I covered. It's a lot of information, so it's...
But this is an important part of it, because it will help us to have a concept of exactly how you intend to remove the vegetation.
To treat. And it's really important to, you know, one thing that I think is really important is that this PIR doesn't only contemplate initial treatments, but it contemplates maintenance. Mm-hmm. We're dealing with a system of vegetation that requires maintenance activities as well. And that varies by veg type and aspect and slope and topography and precipitation. But far be it to say that these projects cannot be treated once and you walk away from them. So these treatment types, if you will, are a menu of options that are going to allow you to effectuate the initial treatment as well as to effectuate the maintenance that's required over the course of time.
So burn it, cut it, graze, mm-hmm. or put herbicides.
That's correct.
And does the EIR go through in more detail exactly what those parts of the program look like so the general public has the opportunity to review those?
In a very robust manner, it does. Okay. This is a 30,000-foot presentation here. The EIR is comprehensive and covers each one of these treatment types and any impact associated with these treatment types very well.
And just if I could add, you know, I mentioned standard project requirements. There's many of those that address individually each one of these treatment activities. So we have, you know, a handful or probably more, maybe close to a dozen that address herbicide application and protections associated with that treatment type specifically.
And have you found that of these various treatment programs that any have generated more interest, more public interest than others?
Of these treatment activities?
Mm-hmm.
I would say the prescribed burning is mm-hmm. An important consideration because mm-hmm. one of the features of this program is increased use of prescribed burning to mm-hmm. achieve some of those acreage targets, as well as herbicide application.
Okay. Commissioners, questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much for the presentation. We will be following closely. Item 57 is a progress report on the Commission's first year implementing its new environmental justice policy. May we have the presentation, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Katie Robinson Phillip, and I'm a Sea Grant Fellow at the Commission. Commission staff and our internal environmental justice team have ardently worked to implement the Commission's environmental justice policy adopted in December 2018. Today, I will provide an update on the Commission's progress during first year of implementation. I will start with a brief overview of our environmental justice policy, then discuss our interagency coordination, and our efforts to educate staff to build a shared understanding of environmental justice principles and issues. I will also discuss the internal environmental justice team's diligent work to apply the policy, and I will conclude with an update on our environmental justice position liaison position. In December 2018, the Commission adopted a comprehensive environmental justice policy and implementation framework. In doing so, the Commission committed to the principle that past environmental injustices will not define California's future. The policy outlines 12 bold and transformative goals, reflecting input from regional community meetings and guidance from an environmental justice working group. These goals are summarized in a handout given to you today, and we also have additional copies available for the public as well. California was one of the first states to codify the definition of environmental justice, and the Commission was one of the first resource agencies to adopt an updated policy. Interagency coordination and collaboration have played a vital role in how we have addressed our implementation efforts, and it has also been critical as we work towards an equitable California for all. Commission staff participated in a San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission, BCDC, working group on environmental justice. As the working group looked to address environmental justice and social equity in BCDC's Bay Plan, Commission staff had the opportunity to share our lessons learned with BCDC staff. Similarly, the Commission has engaged in periodic collaboration with the California Coastal Commission as they embark on implementing their recently adopted environmental justice policy. The Commission has also developed an invaluable partnership with the California Environmental Protection Agency, CalEPA. Leveraging the agency's experience and knowledge from a well-established environmental justice program to design and facilitate our staff education and training. Staff education and training have been a critical focus of this implementation year. In partnership with CalEPA, the Commission has designed and facilitated two staff-wide trainings, three CalEnviro screen trainings, and is currently working on developing a community engagement and outreach workshop to be held in February 2020. These efforts help contribute to a shared understanding of environmental justice and encourage our staff to view their work through a lens of equity. The Commission held two staff-wide trainings in May and June of this year, one in Sacramento and another in Long Beach. The all-day training, facilitated by CalEPA, Commission staff, and Mary Rose Trock, a community advocate, educated staff about environmental justice principles and the Commission's policy. Opening remarks from Commissioner Betty Yee and Executive Officer Jennifer Lucchesi encouraged and empowered staff to engage in challenging conversations. Based on evaluations from both Sacramento and Long Beach, the training was well received by staff. In the bottom left-hand corner here, this is a graph based off of the evaluations that were conducted after the training. This is from the Sacramento session, and it mirrors closely that of the Long Beach session. And staff rated the training very highly. These sessions were also recorded and are available to new and incoming staff. After our staff-wide training, staff were eager to understand how to apply the policy in their work. Building on this momentum, the Commission, in partnership with CalEPA and the Office of Environmental Health Hazards Assessment, developed three engaging and interactive CalEnviroScreen 3.0 training sessions for staff who will be involved in environmental justice analyses. CalEnviroScreen 3.0 is a powerfully illustrative tool for assessing relative burdens in California communities from pollution and population vulnerability. This year, Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law AB 1628, revising California's definition of environmental justice to include meaningful involvement. The Commission fully understands that meaningful community involvement is crucial to advancing environmental justice and social equity in California. We are currently involved in a collaborative partnership to develop a community engagement and outreach workshop for February 2020. This workshop will be designed and facilitated by State Lands Commission, CalEPA, the Department of Conservation, California Department of Public Health, the California Public Utilities Commission, California State Water Resources Control Board, and the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability. This high-level curriculum will help state agencies develop a shared understanding of community engagement and outreach among staff. The Commission's internal environmental justice team has worked diligently to build on the momentum and framework from these staff trainings. A vital component has been the development and use of a worksheet that staff uses at the initial stages of an application or project review to conduct a preliminary screening of potential environmental justice issues. This worksheet will help identify communities in the relevant area and assess the level and scope of outreach that may be needed. And this worksheet will also be applied to all future staff reports. The Commission has updated its environmental justice contact list and has created a simplified e-list for individuals and organizations to indicate their specific interest or geographic areas. The Commission staff has used this list to engage in outreach via letters and emails to groups on our environmental justice contact list. These efforts will further be bolstered by our upcoming community engagement outreach workshop in February, as well as the new environmental justice liaison position. The Commission received approval and funding for two new positions, an environmental justice liaison and an environmental justice support staff. These positions are critical to advancing the Commission's implementation efforts. The liaison will have a vital role in identifying and coordinating meaningful community engagement and outreach. The Commission is in the process of finalizing the recruitment packages and expects to post for the liaison position in January 2020. The Commission has enthusiastically embraced the challenge to implement our environmental justice policy that is meaningful to the communities it serves and to the people of California. As Executive Officer Jennifer Lucchesi has emphasized, the policy is an opportunity for the Commission to think broadly, comprehensively, and with creativity and empathy. We are incredibly thankful for the work our internal environmental justice team and Commission staff had invested to implement the policy, and we are excited to continue to build on these efforts. We are especially grateful for the considerable support from Commission leadership, Madam Chair, and Commissioners. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for that great presentation. Do any commissioners have questions?
Just a comment. No, this is just, I think, a whole body of work we should feel very proud of. It is a model, and I know we're living it and breathing it, and I think it is going to just make this commission, just like I said, just being a very inclusive model about how we conduct our work. And so I'm very grateful for the continued refinement of this, and certainly the community engagement aspect of this is going to be important going forward. Thank you.
And may I just echo those comments and say that was really a terrific presentation.
Thank you.
So I just wanted to thank Katie as well. Katie and Sam, who's also in the audience, are our two C Grant Fellows this year. Their fellowship will be ending early next year, and so we always like to have an opportunity for them to present to the commission and interact directly. And so I just want to thank Katie for that wonderful presentation, and I think you'll be hearing from Sam at one of our first meetings next year. So they have been amazing C Grant Fellows. I don't know how we can continue to operate without the C Grant Fellowship opportunities that the fellows bring to us, and the value added to our work. It's incredible, and we're so grateful to Sam and Katie.
Thank you. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Katie, very much. And we will move to the next item. Item 58 is an informational update on the Commission's participation in the Government Alliance on Race and Equity Capital Cohort.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. I'm really excited to present this informational update to the Commission, along with my co-team lead, Lisa Lloyd. The Government Alliance on Race and Equity is known as GARE. It's a national network of governments who are working to advance racial equity in California. And in 2018, the Health and All Policies Task Force, which is part of the Strategic Growth Council, and GARE brought together and created the Capital Cohort to advance racial equity in California. The partnership brought together 12 state agencies to participate in the first ever Capital Cohort. Each team had about 15 employees representing their departments and committed to participate in a roughly 50-hour curriculum about racial equity and contribute to the development of a racial equity plan customized to their department. The California Department of Education, the California Department of Public Health, the Department of Corrections, Coastal Commission, Arts Council are among the different agencies who participated in the 2018 and 2019 cohort sessions. State land staff also participated in 2018, and this past November finished its second year and implementation year in 2019. We developed a team of roughly 15 people with staff from each division and at different levels in the organization. We had homework in between. We met about once a month for the year where we got together with all the other teams. And we also participated in monthly co-team lead meetings that the Strategic Growth Council facilitated. I think our team would say that they found this work to be difficult, important, and profound. Racial equity is really really important, and I can't underscore that enough, and it's also really difficult to talk about. I think as a staff, we're more, and as an agency, we're more informed, more educated, more empathetic, and motivated to prioritize racial equity and diversity in our work as we move forward. This was an incredibly enriching and invaluable opportunity for all of us, I think, to be part of this supportive network of colleagues pursuing similar goals across state government. And now I want to turn it over to my co-team lead, Lisa Lloyd, who's going to talk more about some of the challenges, successes, and next steps associated with GARE.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. Will you continue to drive for me? I can only do one thing at a time. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Lisa Lloyd. I am the Assistant Chief of the Administrative Services Division, and it is my pleasure to share our team's successes and next steps with you today. By the completion of our foundational year in the GARE Capital Cohort, the Commission's team had developed its initial Racial Equity Action Plan. The purpose of this plan is to guide our team's efforts from late 2018 through mid-2021. The plan is focused on two main outcomes. First, that the Commission attracts and retains a more racially diverse workforce. And second, that the Commission's employees understand and are committed to achieving racial equity. Some of the staff's successes during 2019 include identifying department-specific classifications with minimum qualifications that may have unintended racial equity barriers, developing and distributing our Equity Matters newsletter to all Commission staff, assembling a team to develop a diversity-focused recruitment plan, and participating in a baseline racial equity survey. As we look forward to 2020 and beyond, we plan to continue working on the action items outlined in our racial equity action plan. Some of the highlights include reviewing the analysis of our baseline racial equity survey, partnering with our executive office to determine how to deliver racial equity and implicit bias training to our staff, and subsequently rolling that training out, strengthening human resources policy and practices surrounding recruiting, hiring, and upward mobility, working with CalHR to remove racial equity barriers from department-specific classifications, deploying a pilot mentorship program in conjunction with the workforce planning team, and promoting the incorporation of the values of respect, diversity, and inclusivity in the upcoming strategic plan revisions. 2019 has been a challenging year for our GARE team. In fact, it has been challenging for each team involved in the Capital Cohort Implementation Year pilot. Racial equity is an important issue to tackle and one that many people find uncomfortable to discuss. This last slide illustrates some of our team members' reflections on their GARE experience. Through their participation and dedication, team members have experienced personal growth, frustration, and ultimately hope and optimism. And perhaps above all, over the last 2 years, our team has learned that government must actively participate in the deconstruction of the remnants of structural racism if we want a government that works for all Californians. We're proud to be a part of that solution. And we're happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
And that's very well said. Commissioners, do you have any questions or comments? Thank you for this work.
Thank you.
You know, it's, I think, on the one hand, very challenging, very difficult work, but also very rewarding and very important. Our state is 27% foreign-born, and that makes us the most, in my strong opinion, the most successful state in the country. Our diversity is our strength. We have diversity of culture, of ideas. We have a very open society in general, but what we know is that without concerted effort, and as you say, the concerted effort by government to pull back the curtains of discrimination and look into the past in order to be able to find some of the root causes that where discrimination continues to this day, we won't be able to make progress on this issue. So thank you for all the work that you all are doing. It's very, very important.
Thank you.
That concludes the regular calendar. We will now hear any public comment. I don't believe I've received any slips. No public comment. Okay. Do any commissioners have any other comments or questions? No. All right. So we will now adjourn into closed session. Will the public please clear the room for us? Thank you. I call this meeting back into order. Ms. Lucchesi, is there anything to report from closed session?
No.
So since this is my last commission meeting as chair for the first time, and I am about to hand the gavel back to Commissioner Yee, I thought I would go through a list of some of the accomplishments of this year, and then I thought better of it when I realized it's 4 pages long. But I do think that it probably is useful to review some of the things. And first, I'd just like to note that this is the first year of the commission's 80-year history that our commission is represented entirely by women. And that is pretty exciting. Now, I am in favor of gender parity, but every once in a while, you have these circumstances, and it's pretty exciting as well. The commission has had a very productive year of being good stewards of public trust lands, many ways, but especially when it comes to oil and gas activities. And I'd like to note in particular that this year we managed the return of over 7,200 acres offshore to the California Coastal Sanctuary, where these lands can never be used for oil and gas development again. We know the circumstances of this, the end result is that we have a major significant addition to the California Coastal Sanctuary, and I think that we can all be proud of this development for the future of our coast and for our children. We also voted to support proposed federal legislation to permanently prohibit new oil and gas leases in the Outer Continental Shelf off the coast of California. The legislation, H.R. 279 by Congressmember Caraball and H.R. 310 by Congressmember Huffman, are intended to prevent new offshore oil and gas development in the Pacific Coast region and signal opposition to the federal government's misguided efforts to open this offshore area to new oil and gas development. The people of California are overwhelmingly in favor of rejecting expanded offshore drilling off our coast, and these are very important steps in order to be able to do that. We have also completed the plugging and abandonment of the Piers 421 production well offshore Goleta. This is an incredible accomplishment given the complexities of this well, the significant teamwork between state lands, OSPR, Dogger, the Coast Guard, the City of Goleta, and Exxon, and the importance of completing this effort to the local community. We also have moved forward the Ring Kong decommissioning project. 24 of the 50 offshore wells have been plugged and abandoned. Onshore, 24 of the 25 state wells have been abandoned, and the removal of the wellheads and concrete well cellars is underway, all ahead of schedule and under budget. We here at the Commission also sponsored some legislation, AB 585 by Assembly Member Lamone, which minimizes the state's future financial liability for decommissioning oil and gas infrastructure and ensures all lessees fulfill their decommissioning obligations. Suffice it to say that this commission and staff have learned their lesson, and this is a very, very important piece of legislation to ensure that as decommissioning occurs, we are better able to do it with the responsibility placed on those who operated offshore for many years and not on the taxpayers of the people of the state of California. In the area of pollution prevention, infrastructure decommissioning, and debris removal, we have had many great achievements. The Commission is lead agency under CEQA for the decommissioning of the San Onofre Nuclear Generation Station, is obviously a watershed moment for this commission. We approved the decommissioning of units 2 and 3 earlier this year, and our work has shown the importance of the federal government finding solutions to the issue of spent nuclear fuel. To that end, the commission supported 2 federal bills intended to facilitate the removal of spent nuclear fuel at the San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station and to identify a safe, secure, long-term facility for the spent fuel to be stored. And I might note, participation in the public was overwhelming, very helpful in raising awareness around this critical issue to help us find a permanent, safe location away from the current location. We also adopted and abandoned commercial vessel removal plan for the five-county Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. For anyone who travels and recreates along our delta, you know there are many elements of debris that need to be removed, and advancing this goal is very important for so many who enjoy that part of the state. The commission has also continued to show its critical role in addressing the sewage pollution issues in the Tijuana River Valley. We talked about that a little bit today as well. The commission supported two federal bills intended to address the untreated wastewater, sewage, trash, and sediment from Mexico that flows into California through the Tijuana River and its tributaries. And we, again, here in this case, have a lot more work to do, but are well on our way to some important solutions. We also authorized the removal of 30 abandoned pilings and two sunken vessels in the Crockett Marina in Contra Costa County. We saw some of those images today that are very impressive. This is hard work, and it falls upon our shoulders to do it. And I think that when the public sees progress in this area, it just is very reassuring that that government is working in their interest. And then finally, in the area of pollution prevention and infrastructure decommissioning and debris removal activities, we sponsored and co-sponsored AJR 25 by Friedman, which confirms California's commitment to protecting its waters from marine invasive species and memorializes California's objections to federal preemption of state authority to regulate vessel discharges in California's waters. Again, California has been at the forefront of engaging on the issue of marine invasive species. We have been setting the standard for a long time, and we're going to continue to fight to do that. And then finally, over public access, well, not finally, but in the area of public access, this has been a very important year. We entered into a landmark collaboration agreement with the Coastal Commission, State Parks, and the Coastal Conservancy for the development of a contemporary Hollister Ranch coastal access program. Very, very important. Again, an issue that has been on the books, debated and discussed for many, many years, and along with state action around public access of Hollister Ranch, very hopeful that we are soon going to be able to ensure that Californians from across the state will have the ability to see and enjoy this beautiful part of our coast, again, while ensuring that we protect it from sometimes the unintended consequences of access. We know that we can do both, and this is a very exciting step. We also approved a landmark boundary line and easement agreement with over 180 property owners along the shore of Donner Lake that clarifies public-private property ownership and secures public access rights to the lake. In the area of public, customer service for the public, we launched the Commission's new online system that allows the public to access, submit, and track lease and permit applications. Welcome to the 21st century. We also entered into a landmark interagency coordination and collaboration agreement with the Coastal Commission. We launched a new web mapping application for the state waters offshore San Diego, which is designed to help users better understand the dynamic ocean space and ocean-related data offshore San Diego County. I had the opportunity to visit Scripps just last week, and what a treasure this area is, and the data and the information being collected is has global importance. And then finally, in the area of the 2019 and 2020 budget, the 2019-2020 State Lands Commission budget of $88.8 million continues the trend of heavy special project funding, which nearly outweighs our usual baseline budget. The oil and gas plug and abandonment activities of Platform Holly and Rincon Island account for most of this at $40 million, along with $4 million to fund litigation costs related to those efforts. Other 2019-2020 special projects include $20 million for the for one more year of dredging in Bolsa Chica, $2 million to continue the new coastal hazards removal program, and $1.2 million toward maintenance and operations of the new records management IT project. Again, when we look at these budget items, these are ways in which the public can truly see the work of the commission as it relates to them. So I really want to commend staff again for their sharp pencil and their focus on priorities that impact Californians. In addition to special project funding, the 2019-2020 budget also brings a new forestry position to restart our forested school lands management program, plus a new environmental justice coordinator and an administrative liaison to drive this new effort. The commission is also gaining two new IT positions to right-size the information services division and continue to build a solid technological foundation for its strategic goals. Finally, the Natural Resources Agency has included $900,000 in an agency-wide budget request for state lands' continued record preservation and digitalization. Also important for so many reasons to be able to catalog activity in our public lands. But again, I just want to commend the staff for their hard work. This has been a very gratifying year for me personally to learn of the incredible work that we do on behalf of the people of California around our state lands portfolio. And I know that I could not have done this without the incredible support of you, Executive Director Lou Casey, and your marvelous team, and of course of the other commissioners. We have one more point of order for the day as we conclude the meeting on a sad note, but one that is extremely important for us to recognize, and that is that we will adjourn today in the memory of three of our colleagues who we lost this year, and we will adjourn in their memory, in the memory of Mark LeClaire, Raul Valdez, and Steve Staker. Thank you, everyone. We're adjourned. You really wanted me.